It's good to see everyone, and to see everyone on the screen. I actually have gotten fond of teaching on Zoom and being able to see 25 faces at once, more than 25 actually. Some screens have more than one. It's a little bit disconcerting to see my own face. I think I could eliminate it, but I'm not going to do it tonight. I mean, eliminate the image, not my actual face, don't worry. So I wanted to continue this evening with the second part of the exploration that I began last week, more or less on the theme of Buddhist practice and the transformation of racism. So I want to tonight do some review, but also go into some new areas, a little more depth in a few areas, and particularly focus on how we can respond practically. I also wanted to recognize that it's the summer solstice today. And I think literally the solstice means the sun standing still. And I was reflecting that I got so used to, particularly with the sheltering in place, to be very much noticing the light and the darkness and the length of days way more than I do ordinarily, not being in some ways as busy. And I've been really appreciating every day there's a little more light, and it gets light earlier, and it's getting warmer, and it's just going to continue with this pattern indefinitely. It's going to keep on getting lighter. And then suddenly I realize we're coming to the summer solstice, and it's going to change. And it's going to be getting slowly darker now. I think I was attached. But I thought of this as a little bit of a metaphor. It's really reminding us of impermanence and just how change and impermanence are built into the nature of things. And I think that's helpful to reflect on in terms of the current moment of change, more socially and politically. So I want to start, as I did before, by acknowledging my own standpoint and approach. I think that's very important to do when we go into this territory looking at race or different ethnic identities and so forth. And as I mentioned last time, my own background is Jewish, and I want to acknowledge a few things about that, and then also acknowledge that, like everyone, there's a lot of unconscious material that almost comes with the territory for everyone. The conditioning is deep and thick, and much of it is unconscious. And I may say some things tonight which are unskillful. If any of you catch anything and want to let me know in a kind and empathic way, I will appreciate that. But it comes with the territory. And I was also reflecting that my own upbringing may be different in a few ways from many people who would be called white. Partly in being Jewish, and for some of my, particularly when I was younger, being treated by some people at times as an other, as different. And then also, I was reflecting, I lived in Maryland, where I grew up. I was born in Washington, D.C., parents both from New York. And I grew up in Maryland, outside of D.C., and not far from an African-American community. And from kindergarten, we all went to school together. the schools had been desegregated a little while before, and so I went to school and had friends who were African American, and it was interesting because I was going back. In the last week I looked up. There was a reunion of people from this community near where I lived, you know, just like a mile away, called it was called Kengar. It was near Kensington, Maryland, and Garrett Park. It was called Kengar. And the person, there was a TV documentary, and I watched it. And the main person who was like speaking for this community was an elder, so to speak. And he had been my friend. We had hung out together, named John Hopkins, a very, elegant man who had moved out of that area. So I watched that in the last week. It was really interesting to see him as an older man. And so that's probably different than many people. And I think it was connected with the fact that when I was in college, racial issues were very intense. And unlike most of the other white people, I didn't really experience the kind of guilt that many people experienced. It was interesting. I didn't notice that. So that may have been from the upbringing. Also, as many of you know, my mom was, and father, but especially my mom, were very active and, you know, marched with Dr. King. And my mom became what we would now call a diversity trainer, you know, starting in the 1970s. So that was part of what was there for me as well. Nonetheless, there's plenty of unconscious conditioning. And I think that in going into this territory, it's just important to know that. And I wanted to make the point that everyone, whatever ethnicity one is, we internalize the unconscious material. So there can be a certain humility that we're all deeply conditioned. And, you know, I remember hearing a story, which I wanted to recount, from Desmond Tutu from South Africa, talking about his conditioning. This was from an interview which he did with Krista Tippett. He said, "I think we have very gravely underestimated the damage that apartheid inflicted on all of us. The damage to our psyches, the damage that is made. I mean, it shocked me. I went to Nigeria when I was working for the World Council of Churches, and I was due to fly to Jos. And so I go to Lagos Airport, and I get on the plane, and the two pilots in the cockpit are both black. And I just grew inches. You know, it was fantastic because we had been told that blacks can't do this. They can't fly airplanes. And we have a smooth takeoff, and then we hit the mother and father of turbulence. I mean, it was awful, scary. I can't believe it, but my first thought that came to my mind was, hey, there are no white men in that cockpit. Are those blacks going to be able to make it? And of course, they obviously made it. Here I am. But the thing is, I had not known that it was damaged, that I was damaged to the extent of thinking that somehow actually what those white people who had kept drumming into us in South Africa about our being inferior, about our being incapable, that it had lodged some way in me as well. It's quite a story, isn't it? And some of you know there was a very similar story with Jesse Jackson. He said this was from 25 years ago. He said, "There's nothing more painful to me at this stage in my life than to walk down the street and hear footsteps and then turn around and see somebody white and feel relieved." Right? So complex, but that's there. So the point I'm making is that the conditioning is there. We have to really approach this area with a lot of humility. You know, one of the best ways to explore conditioning is to be with people with whom there can be honesty. You know, it helps to have people of one's own background, more or less. So there can be honesty without any sense of shame or blame. To be able to explore, make so-called mistakes, look at our own self-image, really lead with vulnerability and empathy. And so in our discussion, I'm going to want to remind us of those qualities. They're really, really important. So I'm going to first do a review of some of what I mentioned last time, which were some perspectives for understanding the nature of racism. And I want to bring in some other elements. And then I want to give a little more time to two dimensions by which we can really transform racism, more active dimensions. And these are all from the perspectives of our practice. So the first perspective I gave last time was that the Buddha himself contested in certain ways the caste system. And I was reflecting on that because in talking with people mention that in some ways there are hierarchical orderings and in-groups and out-groups in every society. And how do we make sense of this? And is this similar to race? The fact is we have different kinds of hierarchical orderings, most of them, and different ways that they're in-groups and out-groups. Obviously, if we look to the history of conflicts and even violence and suppression, most of those are based on religion or nationality. And it was interesting, I read some on sort of the history of kind of European models of hierarchy and how, you know, and there wasn't really anything like a concept of race until more or less the late 17th century and early 18th century. But we have these hierarchical systems. I looked up for the ancient Greeks. They explained human differences, not by anything like race, but they thought that people behaved differently because they were in different climates or because the soil was dry in one place and that this led to a certain personality. Slavery was very, very widespread in, you know, pretty much up to the present time. But, you know, there were large numbers of slaves in ancient Greece. Plato had 50 slaves. Did you know that? That there were slaves. Aristotle talked about how natural slavery is. And slavery was often a people we would call white. You know, particularly around Eastern Europe, the very word Slav, you know, and for certain types of Eastern Europeans, that's the origin of our word slave, believe it or not. It comes from slavery of people that we would now consider white. And it's a fascinating history. The history of all this is really, really weird and strange, I have to say. And so they're in groups and out groups that we have. And when we have, you know, they're in groups around different things, but particularly social groupings like ethnicity, religion, gender, and so forth, and they're out groups. And with people in the in groups, we think we understand them better than people in the out-groups. We tend to give them some slack. We understand the social norms. With people in the out-group, we don't understand the social norms. It's often uncomfortable to communicate with people who are not in our group. And so that's a very, very common structure, I think, in all societies. And so thinking that there are ultimate differences, though, is delusion. Even though we have in-groups and out-groups deeply conditioned in our being, to think that these are ultimate is delusion, just as to think that there is an ultimate basis for race is delusion. And so, and it's not there in the awakened mind. We'll come back to that. And so for the Buddha, there was the caste system, as I mentioned, you know, a residue in large part of the need for social distinctions and a certain subjugation of the native population by the lighter skin invaders of Northwest India and increasingly all of India, who came from what's now Iran and Turkey, called the Aryans. And they were the ones who established the Vedas and the Upanishads. And the Buddha inherited that system, and he was a critic. So our first reference point is that the Buddha was a critic of this system of hierarchy, system of in-groups and out-groups. He welcomed everyone into the Sangha. He didn't permit caste in the Sangha, and he invited all the people in this community to treat everyone equally. So there are complexities to that, but that's something always to remember. He also brought women in a way that was also in some ways revolutionary, that women were able to be members of the community as nuns. Again, there are limitations there, but this is an important first reference point. Second reference point that I made last time is that we can extend Buddhist practice and the understanding of the problems being greed, hatred, and delusion, and see that greed, hatred, and delusion get institutionalized. That was the second point I made last time. And in particular, we can see racism as manifesting institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion, which then gets internalized in each of us. Historically, Buddhism has not so often recognized institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, and I gave credit last time to my friend and colleague David Loy, who has probably more than anyone else I know written about this. The need to understand dukkha, for example, as social as well as individual. This is what Gary Snyder said in 1961. Historically, Buddhist philosophers have failed to analyze out the degree to which ignorance and suffering are caused or encouraged by social factors, considering fear and desire to be given facts of the human condition. Institutional Buddhism has been conspicuously ready to accept or ignore the inequalities and tyrannies of whatever political system it found itself under. This can be death to Buddhism because it is death to any meaningful function of compassion. The mercy of the West has been social revolution. The mercy of the East has been individual insight into the basic self void. We need both. They are both contained in the traditional three aspects of the Dharma path: wisdom, prajna, meditation, dhyana, and morality, or ethics, sila. Wisdom is intuitive knowledge of the law of the mind, of love and clarity, that lies beneath one's ego-driven anxieties and aggressions. Meditation is going into the mind to see this for yourself over and over again until it becomes the mind you live in. Ethics or morality is bringing it back out in the way you live through personal example and responsible action, ultimately towards the true community or sangha of all beings. So that perspective can be a guide for our practice. And I'll make analogies with our sense of ethical practice in a moment, but to have a commitment to transform greed, hatred, and delusion in whatever form it takes, and recognizing the interrelated individual greed, hatred, and delusion and the social or institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion. So it brings complexities to our practice. And again, as I was saying earlier, it helps us to recognize that we have internalized the greed, hatred, and delusion of the society. And in a sense, we need forms of practice which can help us to transform what we've internalized. So that's very relevant to the transformation of racism. The third perspective that I gave, again, helping us towards understanding, was that it's important to see that racism is a construction. We could say it's a social construction. And I think last time I made some mention of the teaching of emptiness, but it's basically the notion, the sense of a construction is a very simple, ordinary English way of talking about emptiness, that there is no ultimate there. This is a conceptual construction. And last time I gave some history to point to how race actually can be identified in terms of when it originated. And there's a lot of historians of race and whiteness, particularly locate Virginia in the latter part of the 17th century as one of the main places where this happened. So I talked about this last time in terms particularly of talking about the phenomena called Bacon's Rebellion. You know, and I mentioned how prior to this, that happened in 1676, and I've been reading more of the history. It is fascinating. It is fascinating to read some of the history. I read an analysis of the nature of the laws in Virginia before and after the rebellion. And it's fascinating. The short version is, again, to review, the short version is that in the first half of the 17th century, things were much more fluid than they were later. There actually were a far greater number of indentured servants than there were slaves. They often worked in the fields together. Indentured servants had a pretty rough life. They were not free. You know, one of the laws that existed before Bacon's Rebellion grouped together indentured servants and what were called Negroes, implicitly slaves, as needing to be caught if they ran away. In other words, indentured servants were mostly English, many of them sent by Cromwell, some of them Irish, prisoners of war, later some of them convicts sent to the colonies by the British. That's actually, they were called crackers. That's where the word cracker comes from. It's interesting. But they had a very rough life. They toiled in the fields. They were not free. They were close to slaves. And what happened was that there was a lot of intermixing. Naturally, if people worked together, slavery was not rigid at that time. It was not hereditary as well. And people could of African descent could stop being slaves. They could own land, have houses, and there also was intermarriage to some extent. In 1676, there was a rebellion led by people of English descent in which people of African descent and people of English descent joined together against the rulers. There's some complexities there, but the basic facts are they joined together against the small ruling elite. Ultimately, they were defeated, and the first laws that occurred after the rebellion suggested a new strategy, namely to make the enemy seem like the people of African descent. Within 20, 30 years, slavery was hardened, made hereditary. Whites were declared not to be, for the first time, maybe I should back up, for the first time the word white came into being. You don't have the word white appearing in the context of laws until 1691, so 15 years after Bacon's rebellion. So slavery became more rigid. Essentially, poor whites gained nothing except a kind of privilege to think that they could not be slaves and were better than people of African descent. Economically, they gained nothing. They were made to be in charge of slave patrols, which would capture runaway slaves. There was a great deal of attempt to make it seem like people of African descent were dangerous. The rebellion was actually blamed on Africans, even though that was not the case. So you see things getting set up that are still with us? Can you feel that? The slave patrols became the origins of the police. The aim was to protect people against supposedly dangerous people. And the poor whites were essentially manipulated in what we might call a divide and conquer strategy, which we see in very clear view with the most of the presidents of the last 50 years. You know, whether Nixon's law and order approach, Reagan's war on drugs, Clinton's end of welfare as we know it, the use, going back a little bit, the use of the Willie Horton ad, and of course, everything that the current president is doing in that regard, all divide and conquer while the wealthy gain more money. I think it's no coincidence that this has all especially happened the last 50 years, and most economists would say there's been a drastic shift in the economy in terms of really a transfer of wealth to the wealthy in the last 40 plus years. So that was the third perspective. Divide and race is a construct which functionally has served to divide and conquer. That leads to some understanding of some of the possible strategies to counter racism would be the best would be would bring together people of different backgrounds. And I mentioned last time Ian Haney Lopez of UC Berkeley, who has done some wonderful work really pointing to the need for a very strong coalition that addresses both economic justice issues and racial justice issues at the same time. That is what's pointed to as something that can actually deconstruct race. Because the point of seeing that it's a construction in part is to know that it's impermanent. It was constructed, it can be deconstructed. It's part of our conditioning, we can deconditioning. So I think that's can be a hopeful point in that sense. So I'd love to tell you more detail about Bacon's Rebellion. I was reading all this stuff. It was really fascinating, but I'm not going to. It was fascinating. And people like Dr. King saw the same thing. He saw, I mentioned, I think last time, that you read his writings, he wanted to talk to poor whites because he saw they were being manipulated and he saw they were not much better than the poor blacks. So you read Dr. King's writings, you see a lot of understanding of that. Or I was thinking, you know, there was one of the powerful songs by Bob Dylan was, they're only a pawn in their game. How many know that song? So, yeah, very much about the same points. So then, action. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the ethical dimension, because I think that this can be one of our ways of moving into action, is by taking seriously our ethical commitment not to harm, not to steal, to be careful with all these energies of sexuality, speech, and substances which shift consciousness. But I want to focus especially on the first two and point to the way that one of the, I would say, in some ways unfortunate ways that Western Buddhism has developed is the focus has been so much on meditation that, especially in insight meditation, we don't focus as much on ethical practice as potentially a very powerful and important practice. You know, we tend to emphasize meditation so much. And of course, there are reasons for this. And of course, meditation is deeply valuable. But I think we need to give more attention to ethics as part of our practice. You know, in traditionally in training, there were three aspects, one trained in wisdom, one trained in meditation, and one trained in ethics, which really guides how we act. And this is not, again, it's not really there. So in a strong way, even though we may try to follow the ethical precepts. Now, one of the dimensions of ethics that's, I think, very important for us in relation to transforming racism is to really ask, what is my ethical commitment? Is it just about my personal face-to-face interactions? Or does it also concern how I relate to the larger society? And you can see where I'm going with this as well as some of the earlier points. It's really suggesting that both our understanding and our practical action need to be broadened. So does my ethical practice not to harm lead to me also responding to others who are harming, or responding to a system which is harming? I'm going to say that our ethical commitment does lead us, if we are ones with ethical integrity, with a strong commitment to ethics, to sometimes not sleep well because of this. If I'm really an ethical person, what do I do in relation to the institutionalization of greed, hatred, and delusion, to racism in particular? What do I do? Do I say my ethical commitment is just about my individual behavior, face-to-face with others? I would say, and not just because it's my perspective, but I think you can find this throughout the Buddhist tradition, that there are bases for considering our ethical commitment to also involve how we relate to others and how we relate to harm being done by others. There actually are passages from the Buddha where he makes this move, where he says, for example, he talks about the first precept, and he talks about it at times in a way which suggests that it's not just about my own individual face-to-face behavior, but also about how I relate to others. So he says, let one not destroy life. This is the first ethical guideline about not killing, not harming. Let one not destroy life, nor cause others to destroy life, and also not approve of others killing. Do you hear that? That's, there are two aspects there which seem to be social. not to cause others to harm or kill, and not to approve of others harming or killing. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh makes a very similar point very often. He says that not to kill is not enough. We must learn ways to prevent others from killing. He says, if you were in Germany during the time of the Nazis, you could not say, they did it, I did not. And so I find it sometimes helpful in this regard to ask questions like, what would I have done if I were in South Africa in the 1970s or 1980s, or in Mississippi in the 1950s, or in Nazi Germany? What would I have done? I think those kind of questions are very, very helpful, can be powerful. And I think we can also look to the other precepts in a similar way. This is from Sulak Sivaraksha from Thailand on the second precept, having also a social meaning. We may not literally steal, he says, in our face-to-face interactions, but do we allow the rich countries to exploit the poor countries through the workings of the international banking system? Do we allow industrial societies to exploit agrarian societies? The first world to exploit the third world, the rich to exploit the poor generally. So one of the ways that we can, I think, generate energy of response is to take our ethical commitments more seriously. It could be something we reflect on every morning. But then what concretely to do? This is something we were talking about earlier before we started, before 6 p.m. Pacific. And I think last time I used Joanna Macy's framework, I believe, if I remember right, of saying that the great turning towards a just and sustainable society has three dimensions: stopping damage from occurring, changing the institutions, and changing consciousness, and that all three have to be connected. But that individually, we look for where we're drawn. We don't have to do all three. The first would be more the protest, and we may be called to that, or we may be called to protest selectively. You know, we could also support that first intention of preventing further damage from occurring by helping to fund organizations which are doing that kind of work. That could be very significant as well. You know, and there's something happening now where this energy to question everything is arising. I listened to an interview with Cornel West, who's kind of one of my heroes, and he talked about the magnificent new energy that is happening with so many people saying, now is the time, I'm ready to stand up. And I went to a demonstration yesterday in Berkeley, not far from where I live. I was able to walk there. And it was mostly physically distanced with people with masks, which you might expect in Berkeley. But people were there, and the moral energy is strong, right? And I think that's probably calling many of us, right? And so to tap into that and to feel that moral energy and then see what calls you. So it may be to join the protest movements or support them financially. Also the need to change institutions. I think to support efforts at something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or reparations. You know, I was reflecting on this because I once spent 4 or 5 days with people from South Africa. One of them had been a member of Desmond Tutu's Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And I actually did an interview with him, which I published, about how that worked. But we, you know, it's striking that we haven't had that here, either in relationship to slavery and racism or the near genocide of Native Americans. what could be called our two founding crimes, or some of the two core wounds of the country. To have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. My congressperson, Barbara Lee, has actually put in motions for that. You could support that. Or, something like reparations. And we could look to what Germany has done in the last 50 years can be a model. You look to what Germany did after the Nazis, and they have offered reparations, and they have gone through a social process, although it took a while, of really looking closely, particularly starting in the 1980s. Of course, changing the institutions might call you. You might want to help with changing, again, education, parenting, looking at Marin Sangha, as well as maybe place where you work, maybe education, medicine and healthcare. All of these have major issues related to racism. If we just put in time in our own institutions, that'd be very significant. Talk in your own families, as I mentioned last time. And then the last one, changing consciousness. One of the best ways to do this is to be just with a few people and look into one's own conditioning. Be educated further. I mentioned, I think last time, some of the possibilities there. There are curricula out there that you can use to guide you, to guide us, as we look into our own conditioning. And there, many of you probably have done such programs, but they're really good to be done on an ongoing basis. I would like to see this just seen as an integral part of our practice, related to ethical practice and to compassion and so forth. So this is both something big and challenging, and it's something where we can take particular steps. So again, one of the models might be, do you feel drawn to ask the question of oneself, do I feel drawn to put energy into this, to join in the larger group of people who are working for transformation? Can I connect it with my Buddhist practice? If so, how am I drawn? Can I say that I want to put in 3 hours a week towards this, 5 hours a week? If so, what would I do? So I think these are ways to take the next step. And that's all that we need to do, just to take the next step. It's big, but what we need to do is just find the next step. And there are plenty of those. And I'm going to actually work on a resource list that will both give readings and curricula, and try to have that, to be posted at the Marin Sangha in the next few days, and a sense of next steps. So I think this is for all of us, whatever our background, I think, too, because it seems like now is the time that this can actually be transformed. So thank you. Thank you for your kind attention. And let's sit for a moment and just see what calls you, or what resonated, or where are there questions. Let me open it up now, and I think we will have to work by the raise hands function under participants. And Bill, were you going to help me with that? Is there anyone who has a comment, or it doesn't have to be a question? I see Veda. Is Veda first, Bill? Okay, please.
So, just comes to mind, you know, when we talk about Germany, which is far away, or 1700s. So sometimes I look at something closer, like right here in the United States, when we put 125,000 Japanese in concentration camps. Mm-hmm. And I bring that up because it feels closer to, I was a child, but what did my parents do? What did we do in response to that?
Yeah, thanks, Veda. So I think this is all part of sort of the same fabric. And so I think it's to see where you're called. Maybe you're called to respond to that. You know, I feel called, for example, some to respond to what's happened with Native Americans. I had a friend who's from Canada, who's what they call their First Nations. She's a good friend. She came down and did a retreat at Spirit Rock with me, and we were talking. This was about 15 years ago, and we were talking, and I didn't know the details of whose land it was at Spirit Rock. Since then, I've known better. But I've had a project which I haven't followed through on, which I want to follow through on, to actually really shift Spirit Rock's relationship to that history. I think it's of one fabric, right? It's very related. And so that's something I want to work on in the next few months. You know, I've thought about it a lot, but to have education, even have, you know, it could have practical consequences, you know, of making connections with the local Miwok and Ohlone communities. So, yeah, so I think it's see where you're drawn. That's the key.
Liz has her hand up.
Yeah, and then I see Katie also. Okay. Please, Liz.
Okay, thank you, Donald, for this very, very informative talk. Absolutely fascinating things that I didn't know. I would love it if you would let us know what you were reading about Bacon's, what did you call it? I wrote it down.
Bacon's Rebellion.
Yeah, all that period of time and the Irish crackers and what happened there in terms of inequality is very, very interesting to me. And thank you for, and I know many, many of us, probably 95% of us are probably taking the next step, you know?
Yeah.
What you said is great. It may be a little behind what we're doing, but maybe not. I mean, I've been doing stuff for months, you know, and making phone calls to Arizona, getting people to sign up for mail ballots, getting people to vote, which right now I think is enormously important.
Yeah.
And also some of us are involved with other religions. I'm a Quaker, I go to Quaker meeting, and there's a tremendous amount of studying and workshops and working on it in all faiths, I think, right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a tremendously powerful time for us to make changes. And people are wanting to very much and are taking steps. And it's good to be inspired.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. And I think very important, like you just did, to share what people are doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, because and to for each of us to ask, you know, do I feel called? How do I feel called to act? Do I feel called to act further? Maybe not. Maybe one's doing enough. But to share the different things that one's doing, I think, is really, really crucial.
It's also that, you know, James and other teachers have done Win Wisconsin.
That's right.
Jack and Tara have been out there. I just saw a photo. I don't know if you've seen it, of Jack standing out on a street corner in L.A. with a big sign. He was afraid to go to a march because of the violence, or he felt too old. And he's standing out there with a huge sign in L.A. on a corner with Black Lives Matter, a big poster. So he's doing his thing where he can. But I think there's been a huge response in the Buddhist community. I don't think you're mentioning that somehow or giving credit to that, or do you think? I'm just asking. I know we could always do more.
Yeah, things. There are a lot of things that have been ongoing for a lot of years. I think it's probably, I'm aware of a lot that's happening, but I'm especially trying to invite people to consider what are my next steps.
Okay, thank you. That's a good question. Thank you.
Okay, who's next?
Katie?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I wondered if you all are familiar with the Poor People's Campaign. You talked about it's a huge thing. It happened. They had a big thing they've been planning for years. It was supposed to be in Washington, D.C. today and tomorrow, today and yesterday. And they had a big online thing with people from all over the country. And it's a coalition of poor people. And they're fighting racism. They've got ecological issues. They've got poverty, medical care, all kinds of things, and it's very, very strong. But they're not pretty people; they're poor people. And so when you watch them and you hear all this, it's real, and it's not. I don't know, how much attention it gets. You should know about it, really. Poor People's Campaign. It was something started by Martin Luther King in 1968, I think, and then these people,
right.
William Barber. Some of you have heard him speak at our church a couple of years ago, Reverend William Barber, and they've got people from all different religions, and then people who aren't interested in religion, and they have coal miners and people from Flint, Michigan, and people from Katrina leftovers. And if you're interested in finding out about this, they could use a lot of support. They've done a lot of work in North Carolina, which is where he's based, in changing some of the laws that have been impacting people like them. I can't, you don't need to hear me talk about all of it, but Poor People's Campaign, Google it, you should know.
Yeah, thanks, Katie. And again, that is, I think, going directly at that dynamic linked with the construction of race in the late 17th century, that again, I think when one connects economic justice and racial justice, it's a direct way to deconstruct racism. So
yeah.
I think very important movement. And Reverend Barber is one of the, I think, the great leaders of our time.
I think so too.
So Shia has a hand up.
Okay. Go ahead, Shia. Yeah, hi. You have to unmute.
I was really amazed when you related the story that Jesse Jackson, when he looks behind him and he's worried about who's coming behind him, he's grateful that it's not a black person. I may be paraphrasing what you said, but I think...
That's right.
It just struck me how deep this all goes. I mean, racism and the fear of black people is, if people like Jesse Jackson have that internalized, what about the rest of us? I mean, we all do. So I think, if you're going to work on this issue, you've got to approach it from two sides of the, do something socially out there with organizations. But it's such a deep, deeply ingrained attitude in all people in this country that I think we have to work on that part too.
Yeah, thanks, Shia. That's really, really... If I had to summarize where I'm coming from, it's really to be connecting the inner work and the social response. Again, according to where one feels drawn, but yeah, those stories are, I think they can be helpful in the sense that one understands that the conditioning is in everyone. And it's strong. When they do research, they certainly find that internalized racism is there with all people, including, for example, African Americans. You know, and so that's very important to know. I think it can, in a sense, make it all a little bit less personal. You know, it's what gets deposited in us in our upbringing and further, and that many people, including Ruth King and Rhonda McGee, those are two leaders in using mindfulness to work with the conditioning. And they've developed programs to help do that. So again, I didn't go into that in depth, but they are some of the people really leading that way of combining, especially focusing on the inner work. And everyone has to do it. I mean, I have African-American friends who've been part of multi-year groups on internalized oppression. And they work together with other African Americans, and it takes a long time, and there's a lot there, and it surfaces in all sorts of ways, right? So I think that can lead to quite a bit of compassion and empathy. Maybe it's nice to, I think I'll finish with that point. The way of holding all of this is to know that there's tremendous, in some ways unnecessary, pain here, and that it's impacted, it's influenced everyone. So let's go, I think, now to the meta cards, and then we can finish up a little bit later.